Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, declaring that, thanks largely to his tax cuts, the economy is strong and getting stronger, and prosperity will soon reach every corner of America, George W. Bush proposed his 2005 budget last week. But is media coverage clarifying the potential impact of the $2.4 trillion package, or just making a confusing issue more confusing? We'll hear from Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Also on the show, despite the best hopes of the Bush administration, the story of what George Bush did and didn't do during his Vietnam-era National Guard service isn't going away just yet. That's a sharp contrast to 2000, when media didn't seem to much care. Some of the most comprehensive reporting this time round is being done by Salon.com senior editor Eric Bollert. We'll talk with him about that story. But first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
The media were buzzing when George W. Bush agreed to sit down with NBC's Tim Russert for an hour-long Meet the Press interview on February 8th. Some wondered if the hardened newsman Russert wouldn't eat George W. Bush alive. But when the interview hit the airwaves Sunday morning, it wasn't Russert's tough questioning of Bush that was remarkable. Quite the contrary, as Russert allowed Bush to evade some questions and failed to follow up on some of Bush's obvious distortions. When Russert asked Bush if he'd release all the records of his National Guard service, Bush's response was curious. Quote, "Yes, absolutely. We did so in 2000, by the way." Close quote. Of course, anyone following that story knows that Bush did not release all the available records 4 years ago. They haven't even done so now. But Russert let it slide. In explaining the federal deficit, Bush claimed, quote, "The budget I just proposed to Congress cuts the deficit in half in 5 years," close quote. But straightforward reporting had already revealed the release of 5-year projections, rather than usual 10-year, as something of a ruse. As the New York Times explained 5 days before the Meet the Press interview, quote, "In offering a plan to cut the federal deficit in half by 2009, President Bush ignored more than $1.5 trillion in tax cuts and spending commitments that come due shortly afterward," close quote. The Times also noted that Bush's budget numbers exclude, quote, "most of the cost of the Medicare prescription bill and all of the cost of keeping American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan beyond this year," close quote. But Russert failed to follow up on this pretty obvious distortion. So why didn't Russert live up to his reputation as a Sunday morning pit bull? Well, maybe that reputation is somewhat exaggerated to begin with. As the London-based Financial Times put it on February 6th, Russert is, quote, "an interviewer who, by America's standards of deferential on-air treatment of politicians, is known for his combative style, awkward questions, and persistent follow-ups," close quote. In other words, it's all relative.
There's a lot of discussion in the press right now about George Bush's credibility, from his claims about pre-war intelligence on Iraq to his accounting of his service in the National Guard. Usually, once media get hold of a theme like that, they look for more things to fit it. So it's kind of interesting that the press have so far failed to make much of another story that would fit right in with the "how credible is Bush" motif. It seems the White House had to backpedal recently on a claim that Bush made in his 2002 State of the Union address. Bush said then that diagrams of American nuclear power plants were among, quote, "our discoveries in Afghanistan that confirmed our worst fears," close quote. Actually, there were no such diagrams found, as the White House acknowledged after the group Greenpeace released a letter from an official at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission casting doubt on the claim. Apparently, the administration came up with the assertion based on various of their intelligence sources. Sounds familiar. As a White House spokesman told the Wall Street Journal, which did a February 11th report on the revelation, beyond those intelligence sources, quote, "there's no additional basis for the language in the speech that we have found," close quote. Sounds like a story to us, but as Columbia Journalism Review pointed out in an item on their campaign coverage blog, apart from that Wall Street Journal piece, big media aren't exactly running with it. The New York Times tucked the revelation at the bottom of page A22, and even then could only make themselves say that Bush, quote, "was probably wrong," close quote, when he said that blueprints for U.S. nuclear power plants had been found in Afghanistan. Even that was better than the Washington Post, which has yet to report the story in their paper edition. They seem to feel that the most it merits is a link to the Journal and Times stories in an online-only White House briefing column.
In a February 3rd column about elections at Pacifica Radio's Washington, D.C. station, WPFW, Washington Post columnist Mark Fisher warned that a group of extremists is trying to hijack the station. Fisher wrote, quote, "An election this week will determine whether a generation of young people in this region will grow up hearing America's most important musical heritage or a steady diet of political propaganda," close quote. Fisher describes a battle raging between a group he says is trying to protect the station's tradition of jazz programming and a group that he claims is trying to remove jazz from the station and replace it with, quote, "political whining and grousing of the most one-sided and ill-informed sort," close quote. Attempting to support his argument, Fisher writes, quote, "At question is whether WPFW will remain true to the mission it assigned itself when it signed on in 1977, close quote. Fisher then cites part of the station's mission statement, quote, "Jazz, a major American art form which grows from the African-American experience, will be the major music programming," close quote. But he omits the part that begins, quote, "WPFW is dedicated to programming which reflects progressive social change and democracy," close quote. In researching candidates for the WPFW elections, which ended February 5th, we were not able to find any candidate calling for the banishing of jazz from the station. We wonder why Fisher neglected to name even one of the supposed schemers. In the end, it's Fisher's column that sounds sort of like ill-informed political whining and grousing. We should note that WPFW carries this show.
Thank you, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The Houston Chronicle joked that with his 2005 federal budget, George W. Bush has made good on his promise to bring bipartisanship to Washington because both parties have problems with the $2.4 trillion package. Reporters have aired a range of criticisms of the administration's proposals from a number of perspectives, but media watchers know that economics coverage is dominated by spin. Everything depends on which numbers you emphasize and which you ignore. So the general public often doesn't really know how a budget will fall out until it starts, well, falling out. Here to help us dissect the coverage we are getting is Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the weekly Economic Reporting Review, which appears on that group's website, cepr.net. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we even talk about what's in the new federal budget, I know you have some thoughts about the terms in which journalists tend to present budget information. What do you think the problem is there?
Well, one of the things, I mention this regularly in the Economic Reporting Review, but one of the things that I really don't think anyone could even argue with us on is that, you know, when you refer to a particular budget item, let's say TANF, the reformed welfare program, the appropriation will be somewhere around $20 billion. I won't swear to that last number there. But, you know, when you tell someone this is $20 billion, 99% of the people, even if you take well-educated people, people with college degrees, advanced degrees, they couldn't tell you, is that a lot of money or a little money? I mean, it's more money than any of us will ever see in our lifetime. But the fact is that would be true if you added a zero or took away a zero. So the result of that is they have very little sense of, you know, is this $20 billion that we're spending on TANF important in terms of the whole federal budget? And what I've often argued is instead of giving a number that is basically meaningless to the overwhelming majority of the people who hear it, you could simply express it as a percentage of the federal budget. That $20 billion would be roughly 1% of the federal budget. And if reporters got in the habit of saying, well, they're appropriating 1% of the federal budget for TANF, you know, approximately 25% of the federal budget for defense, then budget reporting would be informative. It would be telling people something. They would have a clear idea of where their money's going, you know, what where the taxes are coming from. Taxes could be expressed as a percent of the budget. These would be meaningful numbers. But as it is, you know, most people have no idea what these numbers mean.
Well, reporters seem to pick things by the interest factor of the item rather than its relative proportion in the budget. So we've seen whole stories on what ABC News called the big increase in funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, for example.
That's right. And this is one of these things that, you know, it could become an emotional issue. You know, obviously you have a lot of right-wingers that like to yell about this is a horrible thing because, you know, the money's going to obscene art or anti-religious art, whatever they complain about. And there's, you know, there is obviously a constituency for National Endowment for the Arts. There are people who support themselves that way. People care about what's being supported. So I don't mean to say it's a trivial program. But in terms of the budget as a whole, that particular item would be about 1/100 of 1%. So, you know, if you want to have an argument, you know, maybe we shouldn't be spending this money on the art, maybe we should, but the point is it will make zero difference. You know, if you're thinking, you know, here are your tax dollars, you won't even notice. We can make it zero or we could double it. It's such a trivial item in the budget. It makes no difference in terms of the deficit or what people are paying in taxes.
So what are some of the elements in this new budget package that you think might perhaps be beneath mainstream media's radar? What are some of the factors there?
Well, one of the biggest that I think really deserves attention, both because it's big, but also because, you know, it's important public priorities, is what's going on with the military budget over the last, you know, 3 or 4 years. In the Clinton administration, the military budget was roughly 3% of GDP, at that time about $300 billion. Currently, we're looking at military budgets that are over 4% of GDP. And then if you add in the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, these are now, the Bush administration has been treating these as supplemental, separate items. But if you add those in, we're up around 5% of GDP. This is quite a big boost in spending, and it's received almost no attention. I mean, obviously the war has, but, you know, again, the implication is even if we were to get our troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan tomorrow, we'd still be spending over 4% of GDP on defense, on the military. And again, just to give someone a comparison, that increase of more than 1 percentage point in GDP from 3 to 4%, that's larger than the projected shortfall in Social Security over the next 75 years. So we have a lot of people running around saying we should be really worried about Social Security, but without even any public debate, we've increased defense spending by a larger amount over the span of 3 years.
Well, several accounts that I've read have indicated that military spending is going to increase and non-military discretionary spending, I've read, will be held to an increase of 1% or less. But you think there's something missing even from that, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, two parts of I'll just keep it simple. When you say an increase of 1% or less, I think they're now talking about 0.5%, but, you know, whatever, this isn't in stone. But the point is that we expect spending in general to increase both because of inflation, which is running somewhere in the order of 2.5% a year. I mean, that's what's being projected. That's not my number. That's, you know, the government projections on that. Plus, we expect spending to increase more or less in step with economic growth, that if we have, you know, a larger economy, people get pay raises, we have more students in schools, so it takes more money to educate them. So basically, to just maintain service levels, the Congressional Budget Office calculates this, so it's not a mystery, to maintain service levels at their current level, you have to have increases of approximately 3%, you know, give or take a few tenths. So when you talk about spending increases of 0.5% or 1% a year for discretionary spending, you're talking about, in effect, cuts, mm-hmm. and that may not be that big a deal over 1 year. You know, it's, let's say, perhaps a 2% cut. But if you project that out 5 years, as actually President Bush does in his budget, you're talking about cuts that are close to 10%. That's a big hit.
And there's certainly just a plain old difference between a small increase and an actual de facto cut. A lot of press attention has focused on the deficit, which I always find a pretty murky subject. It seems to require interpretation in a deeper context than it's usually given. But we all remember media during Clinton talking about how if you can balance your checkbook at home, it's an outrage that the federal budget isn't balanced. Now we hear that Dick Cheney reportedly said that Reagan proved deficits don't matter. What should we make of this $520 billion deficit? And do you think the focus on it is misdirected or not?
Well, the focus, I think, has confused people more than enlightened them. I mean, there are differing views among economists, but I think there is, to some extent, a consensus on some certain items. And one of those is that when you have an economic downturn, when you have a weak economy as we do today, having a large deficit is not a problem. It's, in general, a good thing because you need that to stimulate the economy. Not to say that having tax cuts to rich people is the best way to do it. It was about the worst possible way to do it. But nonetheless, the deficit in and of itself in 2003, 2004, that's not a problem. But what is a problem, and again, I think you'd get a fair degree of consensus, you know, there'll be a little difference on magnitudes here, but you'll get a fair degree of consensus that you can't run large deficits indefinitely. You could run small deficits, and small in this context, again, the relevant number isn't, you know, $100 billion, $200 billion. Those are real big numbers to all of us, but we have to ask relative to the size of the economy. And here, if we want to make the comparison to a household, it's a really big deal if I owe $1 million. It's not a big deal if Bill Gates owns $1 million. What matters there is, you know, how rich are they? And for the country, what we have to ask is how big is the deficit relative to the size of the economy? If it's 1 or 2% of GDP, we could basically do that forever. But currently, we're looking at deficits that are close to 5% of GDP. That's not a problem in, you know, 2004 when we have a weak economy. That will be a problem if we're still doing that, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009, when at least we would hope the economy's recovered.
Well, finally, and we've just got about a minute, you alluded to this, but somewhere inside them, if not in the lead, many reports on the budget make matter-of-fact reference to what the New York Times on February 10th described as the crisis in Social Security. The Chicago Tribune on the 8th referred to the future explosive costs of the program as the real problem here. What should folks know about that angle?
Well, they should know it's not true, and I just encourage people, look directly at the Social Security Trustees Report yourself. It's up on their website. The program is financed by a separate tax. It's fully solvent for 40 years with no changes whatsoever. Their number's not my number, and, you know, no one disputes that. And what we have here is a little trick that's, you know, it has potentially horrible implications, because what they would like to do, a lot of people, Greenspan, in fact, testified to this today, they would like to not repay debt that is owed to Social Security, in effect default on the government debt. And, you know, it would really be an outrage if the public let them do that, because we've paid the taxes on that. So to then turn around and say, no, you know, that was just a joke, we're not going to repay the bonds that Social Security holds, that's basically theft, and it'd be the largest theft in the history of the world, and I just really hope the public doesn't allow that to happen.
We've been speaking with Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can read his economic reporting review on the group's website. It's www.ceper.net. Thank you, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
The controversy over George Bush's extended absence from National Guard duty when he claimed to be serving with units in Texas and Alabama in the early 70s only seems to be growing. The media's newfound interest in the story serves to underline how little attention journalists paid to this story during the 2000 campaign. Some of the most comprehensive reporting we've seen on the AWOL story has been by Salon.com senior editor Eric Bollert. His two articles from February 5th and 11th pull together the facts of the story and also take a look at the news coverage since the 2000 campaign. Eric Bollert joins us now by telephone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Eric Bollert.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, let's begin with the story itself. Give us a thumbnail sketch of the questions hanging over George Bush's Guard service record.
Sure. He joined the Texas Air National Guard in 1968 and spent 2 years training to become a pilot, fighter pilot. And he was a pilot from 1970 till 1972, and everyone agrees his excellent ratings and no questions about his service. But then in the spring of 72, he left Texas to work on a campaign in Alabama, and he did several things. He failed to take a physical in the summer of 72. He never flew again after the spring of 72, even though, you know, the government had spent about $1 million in 1970 dollars to train him to become a pilot, and he essentially sort of walked away from his flying career. So he goes to Alabama to work on this campaign, and he was supposed to be doing guard duty, you know, 1 weekend a month, a couple weeks in the summer. But there was no evidence that he had showed up in Alabama, and there was also questions about, after the election in 72, he returned to Texas, and he was supposed to have ended his career through January to the fall of 73, but there are also questions as to whether he ever showed up in Texas, mostly because his discharge papers, there was no evidence of him showing up, particularly between May of 72 and May of 73. His commanders couldn't remember his whereabouts, and no one could locate any of his guardsmen colleagues who said they trained with him during that year. So that was the story in 2000. It's pretty much still the story today. And so the question was, You know, did he essentially walk away from, you know, his National Guard duties for a year or more?
Well, in your February 5th Salon report, you wonder if the media will give the story the attention it deserves this time around. Can you talk a little bit about the media's spotty record on this story going back to the 2000 campaign?
Yeah, it was first reported in the Boston Globe May 23rd. Walter Robinson did a pretty extensive piece, ran on page one, laid out all the details I talked about, did lots of reporting with the Bush's commanders and things like that. And there it sat. And it got a brief life in literally the last week of the campaign when some Democratic senators returned to it, people like Senator Inouye and Kerry, Bob Kerry, and they wanted to make a point that, you know, Al Gore had served in Vietnam, but where was George Bush? It's amazing how little attention it got, because so much of the 2000 campaign coverage was sort of, you know, this character issue. And there was, you know, endless detailing about Al Gore and, you know, his sort of personal foibles and whether he exaggerated and whether he was a phony. And if he said a girl had to stand in her Sarasota classroom because it was too crowded, as he said during the first debate, well, you know, they scurried down to Florida to find out, well, she wasn't still standing because, you know, the school crowding wasn't that bad. So the next day we had headlines about Al Gore being an exaggerator because he sort of slip of the tongue. And here's George Bush, legitimate questions, questions at the time that the Bush campaign didn't really even challenge. They never said the Boston Globe got it all wrong, showing that he didn't show up for duty for a year, and it got almost no play. I mean, the story broke in May of 2000. The New York Times didn't even mention it in its news pages for 2 months. I think they made 3 mentions in the whole campaign. And, you know, they weren't really alone. It was just a collective turn of the head, really. I mean, the Boston Globe put the story out there, and everyone looked at it and kept walking and showed no interest. And it's literally the exact same story that is now, it's safe to say, has sort of consumed the press corps for the last 5 days.
Well, you mentioned the New York Times. It's played a special role in this story. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, like I said, the Globe piece came out on May 23rd of 2000. In July 11th, the Times ran a big front-page story about, sort of biographical piece about Al Gore's time in Vietnam. And then they also ran a sidebar, a 1,000-word story about George Bush's time in the Texas National Guard. And, you know, incredibly, even though the Globe had raised very serious questions about Bush's National Guard record, the Times does a story about Bush's National Guard time and never mentions that there are these questions. 2 weeks later, they came back with a 3,000-word story, sort of biographical, Bush post-Yale, you know, his time in Houston in the early 70s. They devoted about 300 words to, you know, any questions about his service in the National Guard. And then when the story came up right on the eve of the election, the Times did a piece, 500-word piece, essentially trying to undercut the Boston Globe story, saying, you know, the Bush campaign actually had documents to prove that Bush showed up, and, you know, maybe these doubts were overblown. And so the Times, sort of in a way, by ignoring it throughout the summer and then coming to the Bush's defense on the eve of the election, I mean, I think they sent a signal to the rest of the press corps saying that this story is not really, you know, worth attention and that it's not really legitimate. And again, it's literally exact same story, which every news organization is now detailing this week.
The story is making headlines every day. To what do you attribute the media's new interest? What sparked this new inquisitive energy?
Well, it had such a strange beginning because initially it began during the Democratic debate in January when Peter Jennings challenged retired General Wesley Clark to divorce himself from comments that Michael Moore, the documentary, had made at a Clark rally, saying that Bush was a deserter. And Clark said, well, you know, I haven't really looked into it. He has his own right to say what he wants to say. And then some of the Republicans and some of the pundits took Clark to task, saying, you know, it was outrageous to call Bush a deserter. But then Democrats decided, especially with sort of the collapse of the Dean campaign and the rise of the Kerry campaign, that they might like to look at Bush's record during the Vietnam War if their leading contender was a Vietnam War hero. So the Democrats started pushing the issue. And so then the press got interested. To be fair, in 2000, the Gore campaign never really made an issue out of this until the closing week. So now the Democrats have decided they want to make it an issue, and the DNC chief, Terry McAuliffe, was out front on the issue. But also, I think Bush has been caught in a down cycle in terms of his press coverage. His poll numbers are down, which I think usually sparks more interest from the press. And they've bungled it pretty badly. I mean, it's just a classic case of not releasing documents to answer the questions. And then when they did release the payroll and the retirement summary points documents on Tuesday, it was sort of a colossal failure. It was probably the worst press briefing Scott McClellan has ever had. He was just, you know, bombarded with questions for at least half an hour from reporters who looked at these documents, and they said, you know, this is supposed to prove your case, and half of them were unreadable, and the other half never proved that he showed up in Alabama. So they haven't done a very good job with the document dump, and they continue to refuse to release all Bush's military records, as he said on Meet the Press on Sunday that he would. So the interest is that there's still lingering questions, and the White House will not release enough documents to answer the questions.
Eric Bollert, how do you see the future of this story? Will it die down or will it keep raging?
Well, it depends. I think it's probably going to die down. I mean, it got very hot this week, and it'll just depend on what the White House releases in terms of documents and if they are able to, you know, really address any of the resolving questions.
We've been speaking with Eric Bollert. You can read his work on Bush's National Guard service at Salon.com. Thanks for joining us, Eric Bollert.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. And be sure and tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. To hear Counterspin on the web or to find out more about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.